Someone has a head injury. Can we determine if they need CT?
Paying cash at Walmart is often cheaper than the Medicare copay.
Why aren't people who have a hip fracture being given medicines for osteoporosis?
And the persistence of Ebola virus.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on July 27th, 2018.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine, and recording on my last day visiting my birth state of Alaska. So, Elizabeth, it's nice to be recording with you in the wee hours of the morning.
The wee hours of the morning for you, of course, not for me. Mid-morning here on the East Coast. Let's turn first, if you will, to one of yours. This was a case report in Lancet Infectious Diseases on a persistent case of Ebola virus infection.
We reported about this Ebola virus back as early as 2014 because there was an epidemic in West Africa during that time from 2014 to the early part of 2015. The epidemic ended. However, there's a report in November of 2015 of a 15-year-old boy who tested positive for Ebola virus in Liberia without any reported epidemic and with no exposure, and it raised the possibility that he had received it from a persistently infected individual. Unfortunately, he died from Ebola virus. They did case investigation, and then they did some molecular genetic analysis looking at a linkage between him and the previous infection in Liberia. And what they discovered was that he probably received transmission from his mother, who had been infected in 2014 and was thought to be persistently infected because she delivered another child in late 2015. About a month later, had some viral type symptoms, and she had already had serology that proved that she had previously been infected, and then infected her son, her husband, and two other of her son's siblings as well. So this is the first alleged reported incidence of infection transmission from a persistently viremic mother to her children and husband.
What happened with regard to the pregnancy?
Pregnancy went fine. The authors of this case report hypothesize that because pregnancy is a time of immunosuppression, that it allowed the virus, which is latent or dormant in her, that viral titer to increase, and that was the reason she was able to expose her husband and her children to the virus at the time. Now, she passed the antibodies on to the baby, so the baby did not have any evidence of active infection.
So this is concerning, of course, because that's something that's very difficult to account for.
Exactly. What this does is obviously raise the awareness. We need to rapidly detect it in individuals that have the symptoms, even though there aren't known exposure, and then respond appropriately in the treatment. This is the first reported case in a mother.
Clearly pointing to the need for a vaccine.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's turn from here to a much more first world problem, if you will. This was in JAMA Open, a look at the use of osteoporosis medicines in people who have had a hip fracture. This is a really important issue that over the years we've talked about so many times, really the straight line relationship between hip fracture, subsequent rehabilitation facilities, and frank death in people who have this experience. One of the recommendations, of course, is when someone has a hip fracture, gosh, let's assess their bone density and let's put them on osteoporosis meds to try to reduce their risk of a subsequent fracture. And when we take a look at subsequent fractures in those who have already had one hip fracture, it turns out that 15 to 25% of those folks will have a second fracture within 10 years. So using osteoporosis meds is really an important thing. These investigators took data from a commercial insurance claims database between 2004 and 2015 and basically established that there was a continuous decline over the study years in osteoporosis medication initiation rates post-hip fracture from 9.8% in 2004 to 3.3% in 2015. I have to say, I think that's really pretty pathetic. When they took a look at, all right, what will that suggest with regard to rates of subsequent fracture, they were able to calculate a rate difference of 4.2 events per 100 person years in subsequent fractures associated with osteoporosis treatment initiation compared without using that. And the authors suggest that, is this a place where we should have a mandate that if you don't initiate osteoporosis meds in someone you're discharging with a hip fracture, there's going to be a consequence?
This study shows that in 2004, only about 10% of individuals were on it after hip fracture. Now, only about 3% of individuals are. That's really bad. There are some concerns because these medicines are associated with an atypical kind of fracture in the femur. Well, for every 1,000 individuals treated over the course of 3 years, only 1.7 will have that atypical fracture, but the medicine will prevent 100 osteoporotic fractures. And for people that say, well, I have a hard time taking a daily medication, you can have a shot either once a year or twice a year that increases your compliance with these medications. So, as you've mentioned, we do a really poor job of having individuals that are already at high risk for another hip fracture of putting them on the proper medication.
Should there be some kind of consequence if people are discharged without being put on these things?
Yes, we should be held accountable for these kinds of decisions.
All right, back to you now. Taking a look at something egregious, at least in my mind. If I shop at Walmart, I'm a Medicare beneficiary, I might be able to do better on my prescription drug meds, at least one of them, than if I get them under the benefits.
This is really important because compliance with medication after you've been discovered to have heart disease or diabetes or a stroke is incredibly important. And one of the determinants of that is, can the patient afford their medication? There are a number of Medicare Advantage programs that provide a prescription drug benefit, especially what are called the low tier or tier ones, are supposed to give you the lowest out-of-pocket expenses. We know that Walmart offers a generic drug program in which that for a 30-day supply, the individual only pays $4 for any of these generic drugs on their program. Well, they compare that to the Medicare Advantage and other standalone prescription drug programs, and what they discovered was that about a fourth of the time, the Medicare Advantage program's out-of-pocket expenses was more than $4 for the same medicine you could have gotten at Walmart for $4. If you take a look at the other tier programs that aren't quite as good, somewhere between 50 and almost 100% of the prescription drugs were more expensive through the Medicare Advantage program than they were in the Walmart generic drug program. One of the things we can do is we can empower pharmacists to inform the patients. Listen, I know you're paying $7 or $8 or $10 out of pocket for this, but are you aware that you could get this cheaper? And currently, that's not allowed.
I don't even want to get started on what I think are the social implications of all of that. So let's then turn to my final one, which is taking a look at the big problem of traumatic brain injury. And in this case, most of these were what we refer to as concussions. When those folks come into the ED, frequently they undergo CT as part of their workup. And of course, that involves radiation exposure and additional expense. So in this case, just under 2,000 patients were recruited. So they used some things that I'm going to wrap my tongue around to assess their blood for markers of potential traumatic brain injury. Ubiquitin, C-terminal hydrolase L1, abbreviated UCHL1, and glial fibrillary acidic protein, GFAP. So when they employed these two factors when they were looking at the patient's blood, they had 66% of the patients having a positive test result, 34% with a negative test result. They had a negative predictive value, I love this, of 99.6% and a sensitivity of 97.6%. And so they reiterate that at least here in the US, there are more than 2.5 million emergency department visits annually for a potential brain injury. And that when they combine this with existing evidence, these results suggest that up to a third of those folks could avoid CT.
On the one hand, this sounds like a really good test in that if it's negative, it's unlikely that the patient has traumatic brain injury, but the positive predictive value is really not very good at all. As you mentioned, it used two different protein markers, but actually the GFAP was just as good as using both protein markers, and there's another protein marker called SB100 that's available in Europe that's just as good as both of these together. And secondly, it's only valuable if you can get these blood tests back quickly. So there's a lot more to be done on this, but I applaud the authors for looking for some blood test markers to try to avoid unnecessary head CT scans.
I think that, of course, is a laudatory goal. The other thing that I think is important is with regard to this issue of concussion and its sequela, and especially in kids, whether they need to sit out on the sports field or what have you. And I guess one hope I would have would that this combination of blood markers might be useful in that.
Elizabeth, that's a good point, because when you look at the serum levels of each of these blood markers, they did not associate the level with either the level of damage on the CT scan or with subsequent sequela. You would hope that the higher the level, the more predictive it would be of traumatic brain injury and sequela, but we really don't know whether that's the case yet or not.
Right, but I think we're going to be looking at things like this, because gosh, wouldn't it be nice if you could get a level in the ED and then draw blood again a week later and see where you were.
In addition, it would have to be specific to this particular type of brain injury. This is not really ready for prime time, in my opinion. However, having said that, the FDA did approve these two tests in February of 2018, so they are commercially available.
Interesting. We'll be watching. On that note, I'm going to talk about Medicare versus Walmart on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.